Welcome to the Creative Shift Podcast. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. Okay, so this season of the podcast, I wanted to go really deeper with the people I interviewed to talk about other areas of their life that really affect how they create, how they write, how they share. Today's interview is one of those. I'm sharing my interview with psychologist Shannon Connery, PhD. She and I have worked together for quite a while now, and I have been so inspired by what she creates, how she does it, and really the backstory to all of it. This interview is so radically honest. I am just so appreciative of what she shares and how she ties it all together to make more room for creativity in her life. We talk about the time when essentially what she says is the bottom dropped out of her life, and we start the podcast that way, and I appreciate her willingness to go there, and she's been sharing about this in her blog and her own podcast, and what she shares is a process of how one lives their life with intention, how they open themselves up to creativity, how they are intentional for what it means to fill your life with connection and achievement and what she calls happiness. She shares stories of what she learned working with first responders, which is just so inspiring to me. And even an interesting point about how in her quote-unquote old life, she sort of cared about the wrong thing. She cared of what people thought. And we talk about that in depth, but it was an intriguing point to me about what you have to do in order to find the space, the inner space to write, to create, to help other people. I'm so inspired by her work. I loved this interview. Shannon has a podcast herself, which I highly recommend, called Fix Yourself with Shannon Connery, PhD. I'll share all of her links at the end of the episode. In the meantime, here is my interview with Shannon Connery. Hey, everyone. This is Dan Blank, and I'm very excited to be chatting with Shannon Connery today. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm excited about this interview because this is, for me, in some ways, a different kind of interview. I want to go deeper in these podcasts. And you and I have known each other for quite a while now. We've worked together for a while. And you have shared a lot of not just your expertise, which I want to dig into, but your story in your own blog and newsletter and podcast. And one that's allowed me to see your story. A lot of people have these stories and you're not able to see them because they're personal. You have taken that leap of faith to make it public. And I always find that to be inspiring. But what I found in the past year or so is just continually thinking about your story and how inspiring it is. And there's a lot I want to cover here. One is this idea of, like, the title of this podcast is The Creative Shift. It's making an intentional change in your life. And you have a story that I think is just mind-blowingly inspirational. And the other is just that idea of embracing new creative goals and finding a way to make these things in your life. And you have that in spades. So I appreciate your being here.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope I won't overshare as I tend to on my podcast.
Okay. Cause I always like kind of starting with like the most emotional piece. So you shared an essay quite a while back of when the bottom dropped out. And I think that what you shared is important to start with because it kind of frames, when I think about the writers and artists listening to this, there are often all these narratives about, well, I hope for this, and then this X happened, or Y happened, or Z happened. And that's why I can't. So can you take us through a little bit, what was the bottom dropped out essay? Because it's also a personal story, so I want to be careful about exactly how I ask this question too.
Right. Right. For me, I've written so many essays, so I'm not exactly sure, but I can guess which one when the bottom dropped out was. I was married to a wonderful man who's the father of my children, and he had kind of struggled off and on with addiction, but sort of a regular family trip. We're all at Disneyland. We're taking my daughter to drop her off at an acting camp. I believe she was about 11. And, things had just sort of felt off, but I never knew why. Because when you have two little kids, and I had started working again, and he was a very busy surgeon. And I didn't really know what was happening, but there was a moment where I was at Disneyland. And
Where exactly in Disneyland was this? Because I feel like the context matters so much.
I'd already been to Disneyland the first day, and as you know, Disneyland is chaos. But I always sort of consider myself like a grown-up 17-year-old, so I sort of love it. I love roller coasters. I'm in the first row, all this, and been there for one day. So excited to go back because I knew the rides I liked, and my husband basically sat me down and said, "I can't go to the park today." And I said, "Why?" And he looked extremely upset and emotional. And I just kind of, my heart was racing, and I just knew what was coming because it wasn't the first time. And he basically said, "I've lost my medical license. I've spent every dime we have. I'm like being sued. What else?" It was like everything you could possibly think of that could happen in one second happened. And then he left, and I had two kids to take to Disneyland. Like, I mean, I can't even describe that day because I was so stunned. And so it's sort of like every fear you could have, if you've ever lived with somebody who has an addiction, and so many people can relate to this. There's this fear all the time that it will come back, and you can't control it, and you don't know when it's going to happen, and you're trying to monitor and watch and think, and oh, I don't think it's happening. And my ex-husband, his specific addiction was to opiates, and so unlike somebody who might have somebody who is an alcoholic or something, you can tell when somebody's drinking alcohol. I couldn't tell when my ex-husband was taking opiates or not. There's no high, there's no stumbling, there's no slurring, there's no nothing. I'm sure he had a different feeling internally, but it wasn't something evident to my kids or to myself. So that started like a 3 year, so the bottom dropped out. Like all of a sudden, the income was gone. I knew my marriage was over because I really couldn't do the cycle anymore. It wasn't the first relapse, and it wasn't. I had so much. It's such a hard topic for me. I have so much compassion for him as a person. Addiction is such a difficult thing. He was a wonderful person. He's still a great father, but he struggled with something I just couldn't do anymore. And so I literally walked around that day, Disneyland. I could just remember like a pretend smile. It was just the most bizarre thing. So that's when the bottom dropped out for me, and I spent sort of years rebuilding after that.
So, and I appreciate your kind of going here, especially early in an interview. But I'm using the trust of our friendship to know we can go there in a way too. What was that path? What did sort of the, because there's a thing about the bottom, I think we talk about it, and everyone's been here in their own way, because in a way it's relative to each of our own life experience. But you lose a lot there because it's you lose the things you say, like, oh, there was a change in the marriage, obviously a financial change. But there's also, I imagine, thousands upon thousands of other tinier changes, like maybe living in a smaller place or it affecting your career, affecting friendships.
Everything, all of those, every single one of those, like out of 10, it was insane.
Is there a point where Because so much of what's fascinating about your story is this idea of what you've done after that. And I always try to think of, well, because we like to, people talk about, well, the bottom, like, oh, it's this moment and like, there's a slingshot attached to it. And once you hit bottom, then boom, you can go up. There's nowhere to go but up. But my experience or my understanding is, now that bottom can be long. And like, you think you hit bottom, then there's sort of another bottom, and there's another bottom, then there's like another bottom, and then it's like keeps going.
Yeah,
You don't have to
no,
get too
my
detailed,
bottom,
but what is
yeah.
that like?
Well, it's funny that you say that because I thought when I was at Disneyland, like, this is the bottom, like, my marriage is over. Okay, he doesn't have his license. But all of the other things, like, oh, and by the way, I spent every dime we had. And like, in an insane way, like, because he was back on opiates, like, didn't sign a contract for the new company that I put all of our money in. So it's just gone. Like, it's donated. And then he had to go off and get help, of course. He went to treatment, but then I was there by myself. And I had no money. I had two houses. I mean, it was just so funny because, like, I wish I think of a good way to say this. The bottoms were like every day. There was a new thing, a new struggle to deal with. Like, okay, so let's say you have a giant amount of bills every month and no money to pay them and two small kids. Like, what do you actually do? And so that would be like a few days or months of like calling a dad and borrowing some money and putting the house on the market, but secretly so the kids don't know, and selling the mountain home and liquidating whatever you can liquidate and selling my wedding ring so that I could make the money for the tuition so my kids could stay in their school. And it was just sort of like, it was interesting because it sort of just felt like tasks. Like, the day before, I'd just gone to the grocery store and then taken, picked the kids up from school, and then maybe I'd go to work for a few hours or whatever it was. And now it was like, okay, today I call the realtor and then borrow some money and then try to find, more clients and do whatever. But I must say, like, in a bizarre way, the process was so empowering. It was like, if every single thing that you relied on was stripped away from you and you had to find a new resource and a new, it just was like every day I had to go, okay, I used to fear having nothing. Now I legitimately have nothing. What am I going to do? I'm going to go rent a little house. I'll tell you a funny story. We went from living in this beautiful, beautiful house. My husband was a surgeon. We had a lovely house in a very nice area. And I went and rented a little old, rundown, ragged, I mean, I would say charming, but it really wasn't, house. And the woman who rented it to me came over to pick up the check for and the signed papers. And she walked into my actual house and she looked around and she said, "Oh my God, what happened?" That just goes to show you. But yeah, so I don't know if I've gotten off track, but it was just one thing after another. It was everybody coming up to me and saying, like, "Oh, yeah, I thought it was bizarre when he asked me to get a script for opiates." And then the next day it was like, "Oh, well, I just figured you were using drugs too." And I'd be like, "What? What is happening that there was this whole world going on and nobody was communicating with me?" And like you said, once you get divorced, you go from couples and everybody invites you to do things. And then it was so scandalous, the addiction and treatment centers and the divorce, that people stopped inviting us or, as a couple to do things. So then I got to realize, like, who are my real friends? Who still calls? Who still invites me to do things? Who wants to be around me? It was really a stripping away of everything I thought was real into actually what was real.
So, you've had this amazing career where you've worked with a lot of first responders, and this is always, I mean, the minute you've ever told me this, I was just so inspired by it. Where did that career begin? Was it sort of before this? Was it after it? Was it on both sides of it?
Okay, so I got my doctorate. I was out in California, And then I came back, my family's in Colorado, so I wanted to come back to Colorado. So this was well before. So I came back and finished my degree, did my internship at Denver Health Medical Center. And then just like I think all people when they're young and need a job and need an income, you know, I had a mentor, this wonderful psychologist, Ira Grossman, who was out in San Diego, and he knew a police psychologist in Denver. And he said, "Hey, Shannon, if you ever need help." And so he called and got me an interview. So I started this insanely cool job with a company called Nicoletti Flater. And we did, we worked with first responders. So we worked with firefighters and police officers and ex-military. And we did trauma debriefing. So if there was a shooting somewhere, we would go in and do a debriefing with the officers, or, you know, when the Columbine massacre happened, we worked with all the responders who were on site because there was so much trauma that day.
Can you just take me through what that means, because we hear the word trauma so often, but I'm actually trying to imagine, you know, you walking into a room or some, you know, place with someone who has just experienced something that is traumatic, and it's, I imagine, different for every person, but they're going through an experience. It's like they just fell off a building. Like they're in an emotional, psychological, whatever thing. What is that like? Like, what is your role there? What actually happens?
So it totally depends on when the person who's been traumatized comes in. If it's right after, my job is to just really normalize, like, this is going to be hard. Like, you've just been through something totally out of the ordinary. I need to let them know that their whole system is going to be elevated for a long, long time. So people go into fight or flight. People who've had trauma, they go into fight or flight very easily. So it's kind of when you hear about all that, this startle response when somebody who's been around shooting, like, can be triggered. That's a big word. But what triggering is, it's almost like something happens, a smell, a sight, a sound, and has the person right back in that fight or flight, I need to be ready. And when you've had really giant trauma, your body is ready to be ready all the time. And so part of the therapy is helping somebody calm back down. There's a lot of different parts. You know, trauma has a lot of different pieces. It has that elevated, that hyper arousal. It has re-experiencing, like flashbacks and nightmares. And it has avoidance, where people don't want to go near what they've been through, which is really hard for military and first responders because they can't avoid, you know, situations that are dangerous. And so I got trained to do something called EMDR, which is a very, it's an incredible treatment for responders. It has to do with eye movements. It's really effective. Trauma changes you physiologically. It's a little bit different than other, like depression or anxiety. If you have trauma, you can't just go talk about it and get better. So for anybody out there who's had trauma and thought like, gosh, I've never really gotten over it, you're right. And if you go out and find either a somatic therapy or EMDR, there's a specific protocol that people can help you get back into a calm place, and also to not feel triggered all the time. It puts memories back in the memory center instead of it being something that can just take over, if that makes any sense.
And you're dealing with situations, you know, people who've been like, I mean, Columbine, these are so extraordinary in terms
of... So extraordinary. Everybody was traumatized at Columbine because kids, I worked with several dispatch callers because the kids, these high schoolers, children, we all have children, are calling saying, when are they coming in? When are the police coming in? They're crying, they're screaming, they're... And the dispatch workers kept saying, they're coming in, honey, they'll be... But they didn't. For like an hour, 2 hours. It was one of those first giant shootings, and the departments just weren't quite prepared of how to handle it. Were there bombs at the doors? Was everything rigged? Like, they didn't want to do harm. So yeah, every single person who worked on that at Columbine, you know, they saw children who were murdered. Like, that's traumatizing. I don't care. I mean, there's no amount of strength or not strength. That's not something our brains are prepared to see.
How do you? you go through that, because it's that idea where clearly first responders have to deal with this, and they don't sign up for that, but they know they're signing up for being there when no one else is there. It's unbelievably inspiring what they do. How do you, as a professional, how does that change you, or for you, oh, we have a training because we know that this profession will lead us to these places.
I love it. It's funny, people do that. How do you hear those stories? How do you? I think because I adore the people I work with so much. I mean, I love ex-military. I love police officers. I love my private clients. Like, if now that I'm in a great place, if they can come in and I can let them sort of borrow my hope and borrow, let them know that, like, I got you. I got this. We're going to get you from A to B. Don't worry. If I can do that, I don't know. Like it makes selfishly, it makes me feel amazing. And like I've done it enough times, I know I can help.
Yeah.
So,
I
I mean,
love
we all
that.
have boundaries. I must say, because I have children, I don't treat trauma that involves anything that's happened to a child. I mean, that's kind of my boundary around what I can't do. I can't hear a story of a child that was injured. But, for the most part, I mean, the stuff that happened with Columbine or with my military folks, they're so appreciative. They're so amazing. It doesn't wear you down. The trauma therapist, everybody gets burnout, but really, it's very energizing to do the work I do.
So when we got to the point in the period after, I'll just use the quote, the bottom dropped out. And it's this type of thing where you talk about it with such empathy because you clearly understand the complexity of the situation. And as I know you now, and that's what's so interesting about having worked together so much, is you have this incredible professional life. You have this incredible personal life, and I'm not saying it's without complexity. Everyone's life is complex. You have these, even aside from the personal relationships and all of that, like you've recently got married, and the professional stuff. There's just sort of these interests and this ways of being, and that's a big part of your platform is talking about that. What is that sort of journey like from the place of being like, well, I sort of went to zero, everything kind of went there, and we're just at the point of just trying to see where the bottom is. And then building, I guess I would say back up, I'm not sure if that's the right term or not, to whether is it career, is it personal, or is it just a set of ethos or something else?
Well, it's interesting because I think they all go together. I mean, I could not have changed my direction and done, I wouldn't be doing the things I'm doing now if the bottom hadn't dropped out, because I don't think, I think I would have felt like a fraud if I'd been giving advice on empowerment and how to be authentic and how to address all the challenges that we all have if I hadn't had to do that in my own life. I mean, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I just kept thinking I wanted, after I'd been through everything, after I'd kind of rebuilt my financial space and started working a bunch and sort of figured out how to have emotional peace with everything that had happened. And I just had this new calm in my life. Like, living with someone you love who struggles with addiction is not a calm space. And sometimes you don't realize it as you're just living and monitoring, taking care of your kids. And so all of a sudden, when I was alone and in my tiny little rental space, I remember one day thinking, I'm so calm. Like, I feel so calm. And then when I had that space, I thought, okay, well, what can I do that I haven't done before? And first I started with, like, I think I'll run a marathon. And so then I trained for a marathon, and that taught me just a whole slew of things. And as I would run and train, I just kept thinking about a couple different ideas. One was, how do I give the same, like, the information that I basically give to everybody? Because if you come in for trauma, or you come in for depression, or you come in for anxiety, we're gonna hit 20 things, no matter what. We're going to talk about your boundaries. We're going to talk about exercise. We're going to talk about your relationships and communication. So like everybody, we all have this common group of things that we use to negotiate life. And I kept thinking, you know, why does this only available to wealthy people? Because now that I'd had a taste of having no money, I couldn't afford therapy when I was going through all of my trauma. I couldn't afford to go talk to anybody. I didn't have $100 and whatever to go to. So it was really funny. Like I'm a psychologist. I couldn't afford to go to therapy. So I started sort of fantasizing about, well, could I write a book? Could I do something that would give some really basic tools to everybody? And that was one change that I started kind of thinking about that. But I honestly used to just think, well, that's just runner's high. So, so when I think of writing, because I've, you know, never been trained to do any writing, but I just couldn't kind of let it go. I kept thinking, what could I give somebody else who's been through something as traumatic as what I've just been through? And that's sort of where all the thinking started, at least.
It's neat. It's funny because I think a lot of times we sort of judge where we're at by a lot of these external things, like do I have financial stability or relationship stability or that sort of a thing. I like how you sort of drew this out almost like a mission, which is it's not just the job and is the job going well? Am I helping these people? It was, this is what underlies the job, the help that I gave first responders, the help I give private clients. But you know, that mission has a really hard boundary at the price and a typical hourly rate, you know, retail for help is often, you know, 100, 150, 200, whatever dollars an hour.
If you're in New York, probably 300 here, it's 150 to 200 an hour to go just talk to somebody.
Yeah. And it's interesting to say, that means I'm only helping a very small subset of people. It's funny because I work with obviously a lot of writers and creatives, and I think that there's this interesting kind of dynamic between we want to figure out how to take this vision and this passion, this skill, and turn it into a product or a service, something that will sustain us or can be put out there in the marketplace, even without financial reward. But it's a whole other way of thinking about it, of thinking once we stop judging it by was the book a bestseller, how many did it sell, that sort of a thing, or how many people sign up for our service versus just, this is why I create. This is the outcome I hope for. What are other ways I can create that outcome with it, you know, outside of the product that I know, and in this case, an hourly rate for a client, that sort of a thing. So it's neat even how you kind of got to thinking about that. And we'll blame runner's high.
It's funny because, in all of that period of time, I got a little bit more, I guess, woo-woo or a little bit more spiritual. And I can't remember who I was listening to, but I remember somebody saying, like, you know, if you get an idea or, you know, reading Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert and thinking, like, this idea keeps, like, showing up. Like, maybe you should write something. And I remember somebody, like, laughing with a friend and just saying, you know, every time I go for a run, I hit a good spot when I start thinking about writing a book. And she said, or maybe you're just supposed to write a book. I was like, oh, okay. But I really will say, and you've helped me so much with this, that I really did divide the world into creative people and not creative people. And I tell you about this often, but you know, I feel like there's this moment when kids are in like first or second grade and their teacher assigns something artistic, like a diorama or some awful, awful thing. And, you know, if you're the kid like me, your diorama did not look good. My sisters, of course, looked beautiful. My mother's would have been amazing. My father and I could not have done dioramas. And so you show up at school and there's this moment where you kind of go, oh, that person's artistic and that person's artistic, but that person's is really bad like mine. And I felt like there was this, you're artistic / creative. I'm not, I'll be an academic and athletic, you know? And I don't know if other people experience that. I do think that people either sort of think that's innate and you have it, or you don't. And so it's taken me a really long time to even wrap my head around trying to do something creative.
The way you've talked about that, that idea of like, whoa, like I can use creativity. It was so interesting to hear the way you put it because, I mean, for a number of reasons. Like one, I know I grew up in a very lucky environment at home where I was the creative kid growing up. My mom was creative. My dad had side businesses and he might not have said he's creative in a traditional sense, but I saw him trying these things and they were standalone things where there's a lot of risk. So I always knew that I was the opposite kid, the kid who overworked the diorama. But something that I've learned a lot with working with writers and creators is this issue of permission. And that's often how I hear it described, which is, you know, do I have permission to create, you know, or how can I create if I have kids, you know, I would be stealing from them, you know, my energy, my time, stealing right. from my kids if I go and selfishly go to the, quote, in quotes, you know, go to the cafe to work on my novel. Yeah. Or permission for a lot of reasons, like, you know, oh, I'm not going to be any good or whatever. But it was interesting just hearing how you talked about creativity, like it's this, I don't know, it's like the, like we met an alien race and they have this eighth sense that we've never thought about, you know, the sixth sense. And how it seems so separate for you, especially because so much of your life feels creative to me. Like you do all these different things and you're an entrepreneur, you have your own business. And was it kind of broadened down the thing of like, well, if I'm writing, that's in a different bucket than if I'm starting a company?
You know, it's funny because I just don't think that I thought in terms of creativity, even though, you know, now that I'm enjoying it so much and enjoying thinking up, you know, every week I try to think about, you know, what am I going to talk about on my podcast? What am I going to blog about? And that whole process feels so fun to me. But and I think I had been doing things. Obviously, psychology is a little bit of an art. I've been doing things with clients and being creative in my practice, but just never thought of it as creativity. But I really find that creativity, now that I'm, you know, a reformed creative person, I find it really energizing. I find it really engaging. Like I feel a little bit more, I don't know if alive is the right word, but I do feel, you know, just really inspired by creative people, inspired by the process, like that whole thing where once a week I go, okay, I can talk about anything. Like psychology taps into a million different things. And every week I get to think, okay, whoever's going to listen this week, I'm going to do this thing that I see in my practice all the time. This week it's going to be on perfectionism and how perfectionism creates depression. And I'm going to come up and write something and come up with some points about that and hope that somebody out there hears it and it helps them. And it's, I mean, there's a little bit of pressure. There's a little, but you know, it's like a creative thing that has a start, middle, and end, and I don't have to do anything with art. And it's really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I think about if someone's on, you know, running or they're online or they're just going about their everyday life, because you've talked about this where you'll use some of that time to think about these things. And I always think, well, what do we think about otherwise? And of course, you can't generalize something that's inside someone's head and across billions of people. But I feel like we're often kind of worrying about our everyday life. We're worrying about work. We're worrying about our to-do list. We're worrying about ourselves, our family. It's interesting to think of replacing that with this, what you described, which is this what if, you know, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could create this thing. It feels like such a polar opposite in a way.
Yeah. And it's funny because I was just thinking back to the beginning, the very first question you asked me about the bottom falling out, like, I wouldn't have done any of this in my old life, you know, because, it, you know, before I was sort of stripped of sort of, I mean, I cared what other people thought. I cared about fitting in with this little world that my children lived in and this little school and the community. And I think I would never have just started a podcast and talked into a microphone and put it out there and, but because I went through all of that and you know, have a really authentic life with friends who are going to like me, whether I'm talking to a microphone every week or not, and people who are 100% supportive of, if you want to write a book, go, that's awesome. That's great. You know, maybe in my old world, I would have seen like a, oh, that's great. I hope you enjoy, you know, whatever it was. So they go together, you know. I think that everything, whatever journey you're on, like the getting stripped of stuff and having to get really real. And that's sort of what, you know, when, as I've worked with you, you're always talking about really what does it boil down to? What's the vision? What's the specific goal? What do you want to be doing? And, you know, it's just not a way I thought before.
Well, it's funny. I kind of like how you never thought of this idea of caring as like a negative, like, you know, because caring, we always think like, well, the more you care, the better of a human being you are. If you care about every little thing everywhere, you're the best. And the idea that, well, caring what other people think, caring how it could reflect on you, caring if they like it, becomes this horrible boundary. Because you almost can't do anything.
Well, you gotta care about the right stuff and the right.
Yeah, yeah, I know you're not saying yeah, but just that there are so many elements of our life of caring that just box us up, box us in.
Right, because care is often like another word for a fear. Like if you know that, you know, when you were saying it's sort of selfish to go work on something because, you know, you could be with your kids. I mean, that's really a fear. If I don't focus on my kids all the time,
yeah.
And that's selfish. If I focus on myself, I mean, as you know, from a lot of the work I promote, I think everybody should spend time on the stuff that they pursue joy, pursue fun, pleasure, you know.
It's always interesting. And this is why I was so excited to chat with you, is like breaking through those boundaries. And this is something I've looked at. And again, you can't generalize this, but just being a human, just being one individual in life is so complex. And then maybe you couple up and then it's like complex times two. Then if you have a kid, it's like, whoa, it's like whatever. Then you've got two kids and it's just like, you know, just having a spare second to think is like, you know, like a gift. And then I start noticing when I'll look at families where there's three or four or five kids. So you're beyond the stratosphere of how complex their lives are. And then they say, oh, they're running an Ironman. Wait, she's starting a company. Wait, she's getting her degree. And you're like, I've noticed in this, Eliza, that you're saying is something happens when people let go of these traditional boundaries that happen at the smaller space, which is, of course, very complex. And suddenly there's like this limitless possibility. Like, yeah, even though I've got four kids and I work full time and my partner works full time, I'm going to train and run an Ironman race. And it's just like, whoa, wait a minute. Like you're operating in a different kind of, like there's a different kind of oxygen where you are.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, the busiest time I ever had, I decided to train for a marathon. And, there's a lot of room in our schedules that most people, you know, there's more room than people think. And I don't want to say that I don't understand that for some people, that's not true. There are realities where there's not, no room. But for the most part, I think, I love that empowered sense. That was the one weird thing. I know this is diverging a little bit, but when I worked with police officers and first responders, they all had that attitude, like not everyone, but overall they felt like if they came in and they did what I told them to do and they worked hard and they did the trauma treatment that they'd get better. And okay, you want me to exercise? You want me to cut out alcohol? We're going to do EMDR. Okay, great. Let's go. And then when I switched to private practice, it was such a shift that there were so many people would come in and I could tell this difference, like they didn't feel able to change. Wow. They really didn't. I would say, okay, well, we're going to do the same exact things. And right away they'd be like, oh, well, I can't, you know, I don't have time for that. I don't enjoy this. I'm not going to be able to do. And I would think, wow, this is such a huge shift. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I call so much of my work, like fix yourself, because I do think there's this huge difference between people who feel empowered and people who feel like I want to change, but I don't actually want to do anything different.
Is that like, and I know everything we're doing here is generalizing too much, so I'll put that big asterisk, yeah. But what is it about first response? Is it that someone who becomes a firefighter, a police officer, military, is it the type of person, or is it, no, they all go through a certain kind of training or they're in a certain kind of environment? Like, it's a weird question, but do you have any kind of assessment on that?
I think there are three or four things that go into that. I mean, I think it's sort of like with me, if you've been through some really, really, really hard stuff and you come through on the other side, you feel pretty strong. Like, I wonder what anyone could do to me now. I mean, I don't know what I couldn't. I mean, that whole saying about if it doesn't kill you, it'll make you strong. It's kind of true. And, you know, there's a gift in going through tough stuff and coming out the other side. There's a huge gift. And I think they do it in their daily work. Like, they face fear every day. They go out, they work a shift. They have no certainty of what's going to happen. They're in combat and they like make it through. And there's something about that that makes you feel like, okay, now I'll face the next fear. Now I'll do the next thing. And maybe it's also just who they are, their personalities, like liking adrenaline, liking facing fears. A lot of the physical fitness means they've sort of built themselves up physically, which I think can also then become a metaphor for the mental work. When I was doing the marathon, I couldn't believe. I used to be like, why do people have to do marathons and Ironmans? Can't we just go work out for half an hour? This is so ridiculous. You know, I had all these judgments. But then when I did the marathon, I realized that every day, all I had to do was plan to run a certain amount and then my body could do it. But if I planned to run 11 miles, that's exactly how much I could do. And then 2 weeks later, I could do 14, even though I'd never done that. It was just bizarre. You really learned the power of believing you can do something. So maybe some of that's why, you know, military and first responders are so, they don't have victim mentality. They really don't.
So we look back at the creativity. So you've had this podcast and the blog and the writing. You also did this gratitude project.
Oh yeah.
And this was so amazing to me because this is something you just came up with and started doing and you started sharing it with me. So it wasn't directed by anyone. It wasn't, you know, exactly a part of what we were doing, although I think there's a correlation. Talk to me about what that was and what you did in that, because it's just so astounding as a project.
So, you know, like I said, I fully believe if I'm going to recommend something to my patients that I need to understand the research. And I found with gratitude that I was reading so much in happiness research about gratitude being a very important part of happiness. And I had tried many times to do a gratitude journal, and I had something by my bed and it was like, I'm grateful for my kids, and it just became repetitive and I wasn't really noticing anything. And I honestly don't know why. Oh, I do sort of remember. So my mother passed away 3.5 years ago, and there were so many people who helped me get through that process, like, you know, her doctor and friends who showed up at her funeral, that I can't tell you how that feels to somebody, like your childhood friends showing up at your parents' funeral. And I felt for a couple years like I need to thank several people. And one day I just thought, okay, I keep wanting to know the power of gratitude. I keep wanting to have a reason to pass it on to my patients that comes from an authentic place. So I decided to challenge myself to write 100 gratitude letters in 100 days. And I'm kind of type A, as you know. So I started really with the people who'd been involved in helping through my mother's passing. And so I wrote her doctor, and then I wrote the people who ran the funeral home, and then I wrote the people who showed up, and then I wrote my childhood friends, and then I started thinking, like, I could thank my bosses who trained me, so then I wrote them, and then I wrote family members and old friends and current friends, and I just it became really And then as I, well, it became difficult. I don't know 100 people really well. So I started to have to think of like authors who I was thankful for and people who inspire me. And, but every day I did it. And it was actually really incredible. I came to believe that gratitude had as much ability to change my mood as exercise, which is a big thing for me because, you know, I'm very into exercise. And it was just amazing. And I sent them out. And so as I'm writing some of the later ones, I'm getting responses from the letters that I started to put out there. I don't know. It was amazing. I try every once in a while to still do a letter, but it was a pretty astonishing thing. I can't believe I did it.
Well, this is funny looking back because I can remember it's like the running analogy where there are points where you kind of got to everyone. And then you'd be like, I'm going to thank that doctor who, it was something, it wasn't this like, I'm going to thank the doctor who delivered me when I was born. Like, it was something like that. Like, you just went so far back and you like figured out how to communicate with them. And it was like a barrier because we look around us and we don't think, oh, that boss I worked with 18 years ago, I'm going to reach out to them. Like, it just kind of watched you going through boundaries. And you also reach out to people, and you have to like give any details, but like people in your personal life where like, there was a complex relationship and like you really sort of went ahead and say, I'm going to just tell them, you know, they're not going to want to hear from me maybe. And I'm just going to do it and I'm going to be gracious about it. And I'm going to put it out there. And there's like a risk that's involved in that in some ways.
Yeah, I think it was funny. I started to kind of test the boundaries of what gratitude could do. And I started thinking, I wonder if gratitude letters could heal kind of broken relationships. And I think there were two or three that I just thought, you know, what do I have to lose? I think that if people feel that you at least have gratitude for the past or for the portion of the relationship before things went sour, that maybe it had the ability to repair. And it worked with one, and then with a couple, it just sort of didn't, but that's okay. You know, that's okay.
I'm imagining like salt in the wound kind of thing, but yeah.
Yeah. You know, I what's so funny is really when I think back about that whole project, it was really a grief project. And I talk about this in my podcast that, you know, towards the end, as I started to get close to like letter 80 and 85 and 90 and started thinking who's going to be the last one. And it was always going to be a gratitude letter to my mom, you know, who had passed away and my mom passed away suddenly. So there was no, you know, thank you and goodbye, and you've been a wonderful mom. So the whole process turned out to be a piece of it was sort of a healing and a grief process. And gratitude was sort of incredibly powerful at healing grief, you know, to be able, I mean, the doctor who was her private doctor and had just given her this wonderful clean bill of health. And he was, you know, my parents had one of these sort of concierge doctors who they spend lots and lots of time with and on call. And he had just told her how healthy she was, and then she suddenly died. And I just started thinking like what that must feel like. And I wrote him, and he was in tears. He called back just like, thank you so much. Nobody's ever said that to me. And I did love your mom. And I mean, it was really powerful. I mean, I wish a lot of people, there was a woman, Nancy Davis Coe, just wrote a book called The Thank You Project. And she did a project that was 50 letters in a year or 52. She wrote a letter a week, and she found out about my project from your social media. Oh. And she called me and interviewed me about it, and it's in the book. So it was really cool. It was also really cool that it just seemed to go a lot of places, the project.
Yeah. It's funny how, there's so many themes in what you're sharing here too. And starting with the idea of the bottom dropped out when you feel you have nothing or whatever, it's like how much we have. It's like that there's that much gratitude, you know, that there's that much, you know, you could run. There's that sort of a thing is really interesting. Another big piece of this is that these all seem to be very, like there's a habit drivenness to it. The idea of the podcast and the writing, the daily gratitude letter. And I think it's interesting you mentioned that author because it was like weekly, which weekly is really hard for gratitude letter. It's really hard. And I remember you sharing the gratitude letters with me as you're going through them, and it was like, it's like the Iron Man level. It's like daily. And you would tell stories too of like, yeah, we went skiing today, got back late, and then whatever, and it's 11:45 at night, had to write that darn letter.
I don't think I said darn, but you're right. Yeah, because it would take, because I wrote you one because you've been so helpful with me that I didn't try to say it was not a birthday thank you. I mean, I really tried to go deep and say, this is specifically what I'm grateful to you as a human being for. Which I think sort of that active gratitude for me, like, that another person was involved, made it so much more powerful than me writing my list at the end of the day of like, I'm grateful that my knees worked today when I went for a run. That didn't do it for me, but no, it was exhausting. It was exhausting and totally worthwhile. Like, I wouldn't have done it any other way.
Okay, so you have this whole thing. We've talked about this endlessly. It's a big part of what you share, which is an acronym called PACE. So what I want to take people through it a bit, and I think specifically for my audience, for people who are creative, it applies in a really interesting way, but can you give us the quick version of what is PACE?
Okay, so pace, I mean, it used to be something I just did in my head when I was working with clients because all the research pointed to several things that people sort of need in their life to be doing well. And then I just created this fun little acronym to help people understand it quickly. So the P is for pleasure. There's tons of research that says we all need to have things we're interested in, like hobbies, creative pursuits, stuff that we do for us, for self-care, because we're worth it. And so I always try to see what is somebody working so hard for? Do they have stuff they want to do after work? Accomplishment is a huge one. That's the A in this culture because I find people either live in accomplishment or they don't have enough and it gives them a feeling they might get depressed or bored or not know the language, but it's that they haven't really figured out how to work into their lives the stuff that they're passionate about. Connection, number one. We're here to connect to other human beings and in psychology, it's something rote like, do they have a social support system? But really, you have to have people in your lives to support you. And if you don't, then that's something that you really need to work on. And then the E is for exercise, because I know how much you love this, but everybody should exercise.
Shannon, I have a little
For
joke,
everything.
right? I call it, capital P, capital A, capital C, little E.
And I know there are a lot of people out there who are probably thinking like, I'm perfectly happy and I don't exercise. And I would just argue that if you find something you love to do in exercise and it becomes your space, like your creativity will blossom, your physical strength, your mental, emotional health, it's so good on so many levels. So even though people get upset, I that's part of my happiness program. But so it's wonderful because pace can be used both to plan a week. Or if you kind of have all the areas, if you start to feel a little down or like something's off, I can usually cycle through and go, why have I been so irritable the last few weeks? And I'll notice like, oh, I haven't had any connection. I haven't seen my girlfriends. I've been at work. I've been doing the laundry. I've just been living in accomplishment, which is something that I struggle with. I live in accomplishment. And so I'll realize, you have to take time. You have to see your friends. And that really, helps get me back in a better place. So that's
It's funny
pace.
to look at this as a tool, which is how we've always talked about it. This is a tool that you use in your daily or weekly life. And there's so much I've thought about this, the time we've known each other, of thinking about this, which is some of them, like I think with pleasure, a lot of people, they think, oh, I do things I enjoy, like I follow the Yankees, or oh, as a YouTuber I love. Or I love watching whatever TV show, or I love Star Wars. And you sort of mean it differently. It's not just that you have an interest and you have this unbelievably passive hobby where you're basically just consuming something. You mean pleasure in a much more active way. And that has always struck me as I thought about that, which is, oh, it's not just, oh, I I love my kids and I love making coffee in the morning, this sort of like the fabric of life stuff. Can you just, is that a difference, that idea of an active pleasure, something that you really have to create space for versus just things we like to do?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I think in all of the areas, there's different levels. And what you're talking about is like sometimes at the end of a long day, our pleasure can be sitting and watching a show on Netflix we want. I find that to be a very low level pleasure. I think that that's kind of restful and distracting. And yes, it's fine. But I do think for the people who find things that they're more passionate about, that make them energize. And I think that's a key word for me with pleasure, is like the things that you want to do that energize you. And sometimes they take energy, but to have something that's not just passive, not just going to a movie, not just watching TV, but like, do you love hiking? Do you love to be in nature? Do you really find pleasure in drawing and, you know, whatever sort of things you did? You know, one of the things to do is to look at childhood. Like, what did you really look forward to doing after school with your friends? And I think having more things, you know, I just feel like a lot of people have become sort of sleepy. Like, we go to work, we come home, we watch TV, we do the dishes, put the kids to sleep, we get up and we do it again. It's kind of Groundhog Day. And I think that that's a perfectly, there are times in your life, especially when you have little kids, where that's just going to be, that's sort of the reality. But as that reality changes and kids go to middle school or high school and they don't need you as much, you know, taking time to figure out, what are you here for? You're not just here to work and get a paycheck and come home and pay the bills. You're not. You're here to do something important and exciting and creative, and, you know, take the time to figure out what you enjoy and give yourself permission to do it, because that's where happiness comes from.
So the other one related to that I always think is connection. And this is, again, one where I feel like, oh, like I remember when I worked a corporate job, what I realized was, oh, wait a minute. A lot of these people, no matter how big the company or their department is, they really spend their life with three people or four people or two people. It's these people. And I feel like a lot of people, I love the people I work with and I love my family. But when you talk about connection, it's not just that you have another human being in your life, which of course a lot of people don't have that. So having that as a baseline is critically important. But it was, again, this idea of seeking out. It was, you know, inviting friends to go to mini golf. It was, you know, doing a wine and pottery night. It was sort of a seeking out connection that was different than just the easy connection. And something I've thought a lot about in adulthood, which is most people stop meeting other people once they're out of school. And by that time, they've sort of, you know, there's just that thing. Or the only new people they meet are their kids' parents, and they become the friends. Just that idea of connecting feels like something that, I don't know, it's an art that becomes more lost, and I'm sure more challenging as one gets older. Is there anything to that kind of perspective?
Well, I mean, I think the whole common theme to this, too, is that, like, when you think about it, all of this takes work. And I think that that's a really important piece, is that, you know, happiness is hard work. And I think it's not a feeling. It's not a mood. You know, it's not like weather. I always talk about emotions are like weather. We're sad one day, we're happy, we're whatever. But climate, you know, there are certain people living in a climate of sort of low-grade depression or severe depression, or I'm doing okay, I'm fine. And the really elevated people that I've sort of studied and been around and who are the people who, like you're talking about with connection, like, they foster important connections. So, you know, if it's just, it would never be enough to just have a couple work friends and maybe a spouse, but, you know, somebody who has a passion in something similar that you do, like if you're a writer, you work with lots of writers, you know, having a network, a writing community of people that you can go deep with and talk about, that you leave an interaction feeling inspired, energized. I mean, we can all relate to, like, you have a conversation, you connect with the person who checks you out at the grocery store. That's not intimacy. Yeah. you know, and to that time that you had with a really good friend or a parent, like on a hike or doing something where you felt really heard and seen. And so all of these areas of pace have levels. And I think that when you're trying to create a life, it's like you're trying to find the connection that you want, that you look forward to. Like, who's that person you can't wait to see? And who's the person you're going to lunch? And you're like, oh God, they're going to talk about that thing again. And the intentionality of it. And once again, this all comes from my built-in social system of other parents of kids having really been stripped away and having to rebuild, and who rebuilt with me, and who did I want to be around, and who could be supportive, and who was inspiring me when I had nothing and needed inspiration, and then who could I? So I thought a lot about friendships, and I think it's really important, but I mean, you're right. Like, that takes work. How do you find a friend if you're an adult and your kids are in high school? You don't meet them, you know, you have to work.
Yeah. It's funny, the intentionality with it. You said this earlier around accomplishment, which is you live in accomplishment. And that for me has been interesting to, as I've gone through pace and thought so much about it, where I realized that I have a similar sense of that, where, you know, I love like doing things around the house, like, oh, clean out the litter box. And I'll actually have on my calendar and I'll check it off. I'm like, I'm going to vacuum under the couch. I did this yesterday. And I'll do it. And it's like, I wasn't aware before pace that, like, I think, oh, I just like organizing, which I do. Or what? You're like, no, you like, it's like this, the micro of accomplishment. I'm going to write clean under the couch on a list. I'm going to do it and I'm going to check it off. And I got something done. And that was like a real eye opener to me. And I think as we've talked about it, where a lot of people tend to live in one area or another, where it's like, oh, they're amazing at connection, but they have this horrible connection, this horrible relationship with accomplishment. So they feel bad about themselves, but they're these amazing people, or vice versa. And that's been a really interesting way of looking at the creative process and what holds people back too.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people love that little jolt we get from accomplishing something. I'm the same way. I have a list. I'm so excited to check it off. Well, one of the things I think is interesting for people who are busy and people who this might be a new concept for too, is when you think about sort of the top, like your favorite memories from life, like if you go back and you think about, and a lot of people,
I'm imagining underneath cleaning that clean underneath the couch right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. But I mean, a lot of kind of the really fun times, like when I think back to my, in my life, you know, there was this week in Paris where I did that marathon, and I did it with a good friend, and I was traveling, which is something so many people love. So, and seeing new things. So there was pleasure. It was like this high level accomplishment because I was, it was tons of exercise because it was a marathon, and it was really great connection because I was doing it with somebody. And so it was a ton of work. It took saving money. It took planning. It took preparation. It took coordinating with a friend. Like, but it all came together into this thing that's like one of my top memories, like crossing a finish line, hugging my friend, like just walking down the Champs-Élysées with my legs shaking. And, you know, it was just one of these things. And so if people can figure out, if you love accomplishment like I do too, you can also figure out how to make something both. Like if you have pleasure in writing, instead of just, you know, writing whatever you would for your work, maybe you can think about something that would create a lot of pleasure, creativity, and accomplishment, and put multiple pieces together and, you know, and accomplish something that's also really enjoyable.
Yeah, it's neat to think about how one could use pace in their creative work, where it's not just, I'm going to publish a book, but it's like, I'm going to join a community of writers, or what you said with exercise. And I have a question around this, where it's like, exercise does give you energy, does give you it does give you time to think. It does kind of break you outside of it. This is a selfish question. Why is it so hard for people to make time for exercise? What is it about that? Because, you know, I'm someone who wants to feel well-rounded, and I obviously know that, and I've taken a lot of steps recently to fix this. But it's so interesting where it's like, wow, it's like so hard for people. Is there something specific about it, or is it just like everything else? No, it's just finding the time and that sort of thing. Or is there something unique about exercise that makes it a bigger challenge?
No, I think that is such a great question. No, that's just a wonderful question. So exercise is it's difficult because people approach it. I don't want to say incorrect, but people approach exercise with an idea of what they should do. And so a lot of people think like, I need to exercise. I'll go join this gym and I'll go get on this treadmill and I'll do this thing. So a lot of people skip the process of what do I like to do? Like, what movement is enjoyable to me? I don't think most people have that much fun at a gym. I mean, call me crazy. It looks like gerbils on those little wheels and everybody's there and plugged in. If you're somebody who goes to a gym, you see everybody come on January 1st and everybody's gone by Valentine's Day and the machines are open again. But I don't really enjoy a gym. I think the people who exercise routinely and who it's not a chore for and who guard that time like it's their most precious time, it's the difference is they found what they love. So I don't ever look at exercise as like, oh my God, I have to go exercise. I don't want to. I'm tired. I've got this other stuff to do. Because for me, I look forward to it. I love it. I know that makes people crazy, but because I know what I like to do, I like to run, and I like to do weight training. But I hated spin class, and I hated the bar class, and I didn't like getting on the elliptical machine. I mean, so I took some time to. So number one, I don't think people analyze it, and number two, I think that people give exercise a job, and then when it doesn't. It doesn't have the result that people want. So I'm exercising to lose weight. And so if you don't lose weight, it's like, okay, didn't work. I don't want to do that. Or I want to exercise to sleep better. Or I want to exercise to feel less stressed. And they give exercise a job. And then it's inevitably going to fail for a period of time. And then it's like, well, why am I doing this?
I mean, one thing I think about with this is how important the social component is. Like, I mean, you always, you'll share things if you're running with someone or you're with a trainer. I just hired, I'll say a new trainer. It's someone I used to work with, but now they're in a different role. He came in here working on a whole program for me. So one, I get a gold star for the day. But two is it's neat talking with him because he just offhand mentioned he brings out this jump rope. And I was like, oh, and he mentions it as cardio. And I was like, what do you mean? And he explains that, of course, jump rope is cardio. And it's like, I never thought about it. I just never thought about it that. I never thought about it at all. And I was like, well, what about running? And he's like, well, this doctor that we both know, always says, you don't run to get in shape, you get in shape to run. Which I think would be for you love running. So you work out otherwise, so you can have this habit. It's not, you don't do the horrible running just to get in shape. And it just makes me think a lot about that, probably for all of pace, but that socialness of when you involve someone else, they change your perspective, you collaborate with them. So you might not know what you like, you don't might not know what kind of movement you like, but when you're collaborating, you're getting feedback from them and they're maybe pushing you. I remember at different times I've started working out and one of the guys is like, come on, let's go to the stairwell. Like we're leaving the gym. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, what's going on? I just paid to come in here and you're leaving. Like, we're now leaving to find some stairwell somewhere. And I don't know, is that part of it too, maybe with all of pace or just for exercise, that kind of collaborative nature?
For all of it. I mean, anytime you can add to connection, within reason, some people, if you're an introvert, you need less connection than if, but no, I train 3 times a week with a trainer and it's 100% different than if I were to go in there by myself because we're talking, we're laughing, he's inspiring me, he's pushing me. We've come to know each other over the years. He has me come up with a goal. We're accountable to each other's goals. I mean, there's, yeah, I mean, that's such a great point, Dan, is that when you add connection to anything, like it changes the nature of the activity. If I went into to do weight training 3 times a week on my own, I would not push myself as hard. I would be bored. I would blow it off more. That there's this accountability piece and enjoyment piece.
So I sort of want to wrap up, and I don't know how to ask this question. It's like it's an impossible question because I'm almost asking you to not be humble. But you know, we covered so many areas of your life, and like something that always strikes me is like how full your life is now. And maybe I'll answer this question for you. You just got married a couple months ago to this man that just seems amazing in terms of his interest, all the different things. Life seems comfortable for you from a lot of ways. We like to think about it financially, and we don't have to get into details there. That's not our business. You have this career that you feel like you're helping people. You have then been extending that with the work that you've done for the podcast and the Gratitude Project. The pace thing is interesting because it's sort of all the in-between stuff. I guess it's not a question as much as a summation. Is it's so fascinating and inspiring for me to see that where there is so much like power that we have to do this. And it's like the things even that you can't control, like control is a very weird term. We don't really have any control in a lot of ways. But when you set this intention and you show up and do the work, maybe something that one wouldn't have thought possible when the bottom dropped out, it's so interesting to see where it can lead and where you can almost think, well, I missed my shot. I had my shot for reasons not my fault. It got all messed up. Woe is me. And I'm just so inspired in so many levels by everything that you've created and how you live. Just that idea of just illustrating that growth and illustrating that intention. So actually, I guess I just want to say thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Yeah, it's so funny because, I think that part of my process before when I was married was, it was funny. It was almost like wanting to be part of the popular girls or wanting to be part of the country club group and seeking things out that weren't necessarily authentic. And then when the bottom dropped out, I found this, wonderful man who was became a very good friend of mine, and was struggling with some of the same issues with his ex. And so we had this basis of talking about addiction. How do we take care of our kids? How do we get them through this? And with compassion and empathy. And somehow that blossoms. And yes, he leads sort of an unreal storybook life. Yeah, now I'm doing things and going places and seeing things I never dreamed was possible, and I feel a great deal of gratitude about that.
We covered a lot of ground, but I always ask, is there anything along these themes that I haven't asked about that you think we should definitely at least mention?
I mean, not really. We covered a lot of ground. I guess just, it's so funny because, my website, my podcast is all about, fix yourself, which, I'm wrapping my head around whether or not how that comes across, because I really honestly just feel like wherever you are, me at my bottom, or wherever somebody comes in, like there's so much we can do to make things even better, or to give more, or to be more creative, or to do something new, or to inspire our kids, or to be a better parent, or to be a better sleeper, or to be a, there's so, I guess what I hope to help people do is to just really feel more energy for life. Like less anger, less focus on other people, and more of a sense of like, what could I be doing to address my part of whatever problem there's happening in sort of all the negativity and stuff out there. Like, and I do think I saw so many, I will, just say this. I saw so many patients when, kind of early in my career who would come in, and one of the common themes would be like, I'm so mad at my husband. I think I should leave. He doesn't do anything. He goes to work all day. He golfs on the weekend. He doesn't help with the kids. I'm so sick of it. I'm pretty sure I want to go and work. And I remember saying to somebody once, like, well, we can't work on him. So you're here. So like, tell me about you. How are your friendships? How's your health? How's your exercise? Like, what are you doing outside of just being a mom? Because that's such stressful, hard work. What are you working towards? Kind of the pay stuff. And I remember specifically working with one woman for a really long time. And during our work, she like lost 25 pounds and she started taking cooking courses and she became really passionate about cooking and she loved it. And, you know, she just started to do more things with friends and get a sitter for the kids. And she created her own life. And I remember she came in and she said to me after a while, she said, "I don't even remember why I was so mad at him all the time." She said, "I think I was just sort of miserable with myself. And I just put all the focus on him." And that's when I really realized, like, oh my God, that was so much wisdom she gave me, that really so many times when we think the problem is out there, the problem is the other person, the problem is politics or the world, or so often the problem is like, what have I not addressed inside? What could I be doing to feel like, you know, part of the problem, part of the solution, not the problem? So I guess that's sort of the only thing.
Yeah, I love that, because in some ways it could be, like you say, fix yourself, something to fix. But a lot of times I think it's also just there's an opportunity.
Right.
You know, like running an Ironman, which I don't know why that became the example in this interview, but it did. It's just like, you know, there's nothing to fix there. You just have, if you want to do that, you can. If you want to write a book, you can. If you want to do 100 days of gratitude letters, you can. Right. It's this opportunity that I do think feels closed off because, as you said, I mean, people are so stressed and they're so worried with, because life is complex. I love that message.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you so much for everything you've shared here. As I've said, I find so much of what you create inspiring, and I appreciate your sharing it so openly.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was fun to be a guest on a podcast for as a change.
You can find Shannon Connery at shannonconnery.com. You can listen to her wonderful podcast at Fix Yourself with Shannon Connery, PhD, and that's on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, all the normal places. On Instagram, her username is The Happiness Gain, and she's on Twitter at S Connery, PhD, and on Facebook at the same address. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me at wegrowmedia.com or on social media at Dan Blank. Thank you so much for listening until the end.